From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Investigations over alleged cases of domestic violence continue to populate newscasts on a near daily basis. A contestant on the TV show Top Chef, George Foreman's son, NASCAR driver Kurt Busch, football player Ray McDonald. In that case, prosecutors chose not to file charges, and most famously, football player Ray Rice, whose appeal of his lifetime ban from the NFL is still awaiting a verdict. Why are we hearing more about abusive dynamics in relationships, and what resources are available to help victims and perpetrators? And how much is our culture to blame? To help us sort through some of these questions and the complicated dynamics surrounding violence between intimate partners, Dr. Carrie Clements, a professor of psychology at UNCW, joins us in the studio today. Dr. Clements, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Dr. Clements, you've been researching issues around domestic violence for 20 years now, and since there are so many layers to this topic, tell us first what the term intimate partner violence, or IPV, means, which is what we're talking about today, and how it's different from talking about domestic violence.
Okay, for years we used the word domestic violence, and that can encompass a number of things: elder abuse, child abuse, any kind of abuse that occurs within the home. So to get more specific and so that people were agreeing on what they were talking about, the term intimate partner violence was coined to mean violence between partners, and that allows us to be very specific about what we're talking about.
And when we hear about some of these cases, the Ray Rice case, for instance, and Janae Rice, and we see the video of her getting punched in the elevator to the point of being knocked out completely for several minutes, there are so many elements that those of us who aren't familiar with it from the inside don't understand. Are there certain personality traits that if we identified them, we'd be better able to recognize a man or a woman, but usually men, who might become an abuser?
There are this huge research literature on that I don't want to go into because I think that would complicate things. But I think what you're referring to is, if I'm in a situation, how can I see whether someone might potentially be abusive?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So abusers don't start out abusing. So if I'm on a date with you and I hit you, you're not going to have another date with me. Abusers groom their victims. Abusers are charming. There's never going to be anyone nicer to you than an abuser. They're going to lure you into a relationship. You're never going to feel more loved. And then they'll start a real slow process where, because they love you so much, they want to spend all your time. So they'll start socially isolating you. They may criticize you for working. I'll take care of you, honey. You stay home. You know, I want you to have the best. And it's all done in the name of love.
Now, is this a conscious process? Is this abuser, this potential abuser, saying, I'm eventually going to get to the point where I'm going to be beating her up, and so this is how I get her to trust me, this is how I isolate her? Or is this an unconscious thing that the abuser is doing?
It depends on the type of abuser. So the more antisocial types of abusers, this may very well be a conscious process. And these are abusers who you see in abusive relationship after abusive relationship after abusive relationship. But most abusers will not say that they consciously intended for this to happen. It was more about issues of power and control, and that they felt very emasculated when their partner did things independently of them, and they grew fearful that their partner would leave them. And so they gradually did these things, they will say, out of love. So it's not necessarily conscious, but it does lead to abuse.
Are abusers more likely to exhibit aggression or violence in other parts of their lives beyond the relationship? Is that another way that you might see red flags?
You can, but abusers tend to control their difficulties with anger management, et cetera, outside the home. And there's lots more structures outside the home to allow that to happen. So if you lash out at work, you're going to be chastised. You're going to get some pretty negative feedback. You may be fired. At home, the tendency for the wife to be forgiving, or the partner to be forgiving, this is the only time that'll happen. The consequences are not there as they would be at work or in other external environments.
You've been doing some research on the effect of loss of control mm-hmm. on a person who's an abuser. So what are you finding? Are victims more in danger when their partners feel out of control?
Very much so. In fact, the research shows that a woman is most in danger of being killed when she attempts to leave the abusive situation. So the more the abuser feels that they are not able to control the victim's actions, the more vulnerable the victim is, and the more scary the situation gets.
And so in a circumstance like that, what do you do? I mean, you are someone who, through your research, you're counseling victims of
yes.
of intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. And how do you advise someone who's telling you about a circumstance in which she's looking down the barrel of another episode?
Right. I have someone in my practice right now who's experiencing that. And we have a safety plan in progress. And, you know, she has a kit in her car with an extra cell phone, clothes, et cetera. She's not willing at this point to leave for all kinds of reasons, including economic dependence. I work with her to identify signs that he is escalating and to leave before the situation escalates out of control. She's been harmed before. The likelihood that she'll be harmed again is high, and she knows that. So part of me is working with her on helping her gain the skills she needs to actually leave that situation. The other part of me is working with her to increase the probability that she'll survive in that situation if it does escalate out of control.
That, I'm sorry, it's just chilling to hear you say something like that, increase the probability that she'll survive. This is someone that you are working with,
mm-hmm.
someone that's here,
yes.
that you're saying is in danger of losing her life.
Yes, absolutely. It's very chilling. It's scary as a clinician understanding that. And I'm very straightforward with her about my concerns and my fears. And, you know, she accepts that. She understands, at least intellectually, the risk.
And yet you're saying she's starting to recognize the signs throughout the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what the cycle is, just the general cycle?
Mm-hmm. There's a nice graphic your listeners can go Google cycle of abuse. What happens in an abuse situation is that an abuse scenario occurs, whatever gravity it is. The abuser becomes contrite, acts on his best behavior, I always say, you know, a non-abuser will never be as loving as an abuser is, because they don't have to be. You know,
and
they're not beating you up.
You're talking about the honeymoon
right.
phase at this point.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so the woman is lured into feeling that maybe this won't happen again. Maybe he will change. He's going into counseling. You know, maybe things will get better. And they are better for a little while. And then the tensions start to escalate again. She tries to be independent. She tries to have friends. She thinks she can again. And he starts controlling again and starts picking minor fights. And the tensions start going. I also have to tell you that in many of these cases, alcohol is involved. Not all. I don't want this to be stereotyped as a situation which is a substance abuse situation. But in many of these cases, alcohol is involved for the abuser.
And so in this case, this woman, your client, is watching the situation escalate.
Mm-hmm.
She says, he's getting snippier with me.
Mm-hmm.
I can see he's more irritable.
Mm-hmm.
The honeymoon phase is over.
Right.
We don't know when he's going to blow, but we know it's going to happen.
Right. And so what do we need to do?
And you can't do anything.
No.
You can't, in a circumstance where we suspect child abuse, or in a circumstance where we suspect abuse of a disabled person or an elderly person, we can sweep in and scoop them up and take them away and protect them.
Yes, I'm mandated to do that. In the state of North Carolina, I'm a mandatory reporter, which means if I see elder abuse or child abuse, I have to report. In this situation, there is no mandated reporting. In fact, if I break her confidence, that's HIPAA violation. You know, so I have to keep her confidence.
So can you understand then, to an outside observer like me, it sounds like she's sitting on a train track
mm-hmm.
and there's a train coming.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying there's a train coming.
Right.
And I'm saying at this point, don't you need to just grab her off the track?
Oh, and I'd love to. I'd love to. And I'd love to take her down to domestic violence shelter and services and do all that. But I can't. First of all, she's an adult, and I have to respect her autonomy. I also have to respect the fact that she has to make her own choices. When she leaves, that's got to be her decision. All right, because if I tell her to leave, she's much more likely to go back, first
right.
of all.
Right, and when she goes back, is her risk escalated?
Every time a woman goes back, the risk escalates.
Every time a woman goes back, mm-hmm. she's in greater danger.
Yes, and you need to understand that typically women do go back, and they go back many times, and their friends and their relatives lose patience with them and say, we don't want to deal with this anymore. It's been 4 or 5 times. We've kept you in our homes. We've supported you, et cetera, and then you just go back. And that's another risk because that's more social isolation, more I don't have resources. They do go back. It's part of the normal process. It's part of what helps them understand that this is not going to change. And, yeah, the risk is there. It's very scary. Now, fortunately, most women do leave before something horrific occurs, like dying. But they do get increasingly injured on the way.
Have you ever had a client who was murdered by her abuser?
Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to go to a break. And then when we come back, Mandy Hooveris from Domestic Violence Shelter and Services will join this conversation. We'll talk about the resources that are out there. We'll talk about more about the perpetrator, because this has been part of your research, mm-hmm. Dr. Clements. You're listening to Coastline. If you would like to call in and ask a question of our guests, either Dr. Carrie Clements or Mandy Hooveris from Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, you can give us a call now at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org. And when we come back from after the break, we'll take your calls, read your emails, and talk with Mandy Hooveris. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Joining us in the studio now to continue the conversation about intimate partner violence is Mandy Hooveris, the Direct Services and Outreach Director at Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. Mandy Hooveris, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
And also still with us in the studio, Dr. Carrie Clements, Professor of Psychology at UNCW. Dr. Clements, welcome back.
Thank you.
If you have a question for our guests about intimate partner violence, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. Mandy Hooveris, we especially recently have seen so many instances of intimate partner violence publicized. Recently, football player Ray Rice. And when that first came out in the news, there was a great deal of negative reaction to Jhené Rice. Why did she stay? What is that negative public reaction about?
So I think it's a very human question to look at a difficult problem, a societal issue like domestic violence, and want to know why. And as advocates, the question that we get asked often is, why does the victim stay? So I certainly understand that being a question. And the answer isn't an easy one. Many of the things that we've talked about already this morning, the financial control, isolation, intimidation, using the children against the victim, there are all of these factors that keep a victim trapped in a relationship. I think the more important question is to ask why he does this and hold the abuser accountable, because a victim does not choose to be a victim. She didn't start this relationship hoping that this would where things would end up. So I think that's a really important question that we have to look at as a society.
Why does he perpetrate in the first place? Dr. Clements, you've identified 3 personality types. Can you tell us about those and how someone can become a perpetrator?
Well, there's 3 types. There's the antisocial type. These are people who feel no remorse, no guilt. They do it because they do it and because they can. There's borderline dysphoric type. These are men who have trouble regulating their emotions. They have poor impulse control, very poor interpersonal skills. And then there's family or opportunistic. So these are people who just take out their rage on their family. They may not necessarily have the psychopathology that the borderline dysphoric type has. And each of them comes to violence in a different way. So antisocials do it because they can. They steal because they can. They do all kinds of things because they can. Borderline dysphorics seem to aggress as a way of maintaining a sense of personal control. I control you, therefore I have control. Opportunistic types seem to get involved in very, very dysfunctional partner relationships and that escalate very quickly into violence. And then we go through that cycle again, but they don't seem to do it in any other place other than the family.
Okay, we have a couple of callers now. Let's talk with James from Duplin County. James, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, my question or comment refers to the fact that it seems that if this is possibly a result of the Christianity and the Christian message that that violence is okay. In fact, it seems like it is sanctified when we have a God that has punished somebody and tortured them to show his love for us so that people could be saved. I mean, we know children are beaten and justified. I hear lots of ministers talk about sanctifying the beating of children because God will punish you. I'd like your comments on that, that it's sort of built into the religion of America.
So you're saying it's built into Western civilization here. And James, we have two experts here in the studio nodding their heads. Mandy Hooveris, you started nodding with James.
So James brings up a great point. And what we see is that abusers can use a variety of excuses or justifications to convince a victim that they're entitled to those actions and to normalize them. And so looking at our religion and looking at our churches and our synagogues, abusers can misinterpret scripture or use that as ways to continue to gain control. So as an agency, one thing that we're doing that we're very excited about right now, Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, through a partnership with the CDC, is working with faith communities here in our area, two specific churches, to develop policies surrounding intimate partner violence, educate ministers and clergy on this important topic so that they are talking with their congregations, so that they are changing social norms that domestic violence is not acceptable, that God or a higher power does not want people to be trapped in abusive situations, and that there is hope and other alternatives.
James, thanks so much for your call. We have Anna from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if either of your guests have had a chance to see the new documentary, Private Violence. It is an incredibly powerful film that shows the reality of what women face in domestic violence. And it's going to be showing at Kagoras this weekend. And so I just wanted to let folks know about that. I'm very interested in this topic and see if either of you had a chance to see it yet.
Okay, thanks so much, Anna. Have you seen the documentary?
I've not seen the documentary. I really encourage people to go and watch documentaries like that and get educated. One of the things that happens when we have these large profile domestic intimate partner violence cases is that we're all just shocked. And we don't realize how common a problem it is. I mean, I love the idea of going into the faith-based ministries and educating people about what it is, so that policies or beliefs are not misused to control women. The kind of patriarchy that can breed abuse. I want people to recognize that all around them, they are seeing women and men who are engaged in abusive relationships. And it's not shocking. It's shocking that we're not doing something about it.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about intimate partner violence, or IPV, with Dr. Carrie Clements, a psychology professor at UNCW and IPV researcher, and Mandy Hooveris of Domestic Violence Shelter and Services in Wilmington. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Mandy, going back to this idea of educating the clergy and the congregations in these faith-based communities, again, it may be hard for some people to understand why it would even be considered an acceptable social norm to perpetrate violence. Isn't that antithetical? I mean, given James' point, certainly understand the links that he was drawing, but isn't that antithetical to what we think of as Judeo-Christian values?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's very important to realize, you know, when we see, when we talk about domestic violence, we assume that we know everything about what's going on in a situation. And so maybe a family goes to speak with their minister and says, hey, we're having some problems at home. We need your support. We're looking for guidance to move forward. That doesn't mean that there's domestic violence in that home, but it's important to educate the ministers to look for warning signs, to be able to offer support and create a safe environment.
And what would be some of those warning signs?
You know, that isolation and control and fear and him not wanting her to speak with the minister without him present, and financial issues. And there are all of these different factors that can be at play. But it's so important to realize that every situation looks different. Every abuser looks different, and every victim looks different. And so it's very easy for us as a society to think about domestic violence and say, well, I know what that looks like, and I would know if I saw it. And when we see a video of it happening, it's very clear that that's what's going on.
Sure.
But it's also easy to jump to conclusions that I saw a Lifetime movie, or I saw an episode of Law & Order, and this is what a victim looks like or acts like. And even more importantly, this is what an abuser would look like. Because abusers are people. They're not walking around with a giant stamp on their forehead that says violent. These are people who are in our society, in our churches, in our neighborhoods, and in our homes. And so
we have an email from Nancy, Executive Director of Women's Independent Scholarship Program. She says, we know many victims remain with their partners because they're financially trapped. They don't have the work skills to support themselves and their children. Women's Independent Scholarship Program was started in 1999 by the Sunshine Lady Foundation to provide scholarships for survivors of intimate partner abuse to return to school to gain skills that will allow them to become independent and self-sufficient. And so I see you nodding also, Mandy and Dr. Clements. This is one of the resources in our area to which you send victims?
Yes, absolutely. And so when a client comes into our office, what we're there to do is listen. And not to take control of that situation, because it's very easy on the outside to tell a victim, these are the steps for you. This is what you need to do next. In reality, if we do that, we're kind of assuming the same role the abuser had and taking away her power to choose. So as advocates, we're here to listen and kind of identify the boundaries and the barriers that are keeping her in an undesirable situation. So if financial issues are there, if educational opportunities are available that she can't access, we try to help identify those and connect her with resources. The WISP scholarship program is an amazing resource that we are able to access. And those things are case by case, you know, that may not be appropriate for every client or every situation. But that's why as advocates, we're there to help them navigate the options that are on the table for them.
So for you, then, it's about empowering the victim rather than steering the victim or directing the victim or controlling, as you said.
Absolutely. So if you gave me one word and said, Mandy Hoover has come here and talk about domestic violence, it would be empowerment. That's at the core of our mission. That's at the core of the work we do every day. And I think as a society, we need to move more towards empowering victims to make choices rather than judging the choices that we don't understand.
Right. And this goes back to Dr. Clement's client that she was talking about before, who is watching, you know, throughout this counseling session. She's describing how her partner, her husband, is escalating. And you know that there's going to be an eruption coming. And you can't control what she does. You can only be there to support.
Yeah, it's really important that I don't make choices for her. She has to make choices for herself, because I may be the only place where she feels any sense of control. And so if I assume control, then I'm taking that away from her too. I would say that, you know, one of the things that we need to do as a community is look at the resources that we afford people in these situations. And there are many more of them in these situations than any of us know about. Because if someone is staying and being beaten up because her husband will not give her the car to take the kids to school or to the doctor, we should be able to do something about that. If someone is staying in a situation which is life-threatening because they don't have the money to go to Cape Fear or somewhere else and get some training, we should do something about that.
And when you say we, who, what, us, should we do?
Members of the community. Mm-hmm. We need to embrace the notion that we are living in a community in which a great deal of intimate partner violence occurs. And it occurs at all echelons. It occurs in landfall. It occurs in every community we have. And these women's voices are not being heard. They're often very hidden because of the personal stigma associated with it. And to have as many options possible. So when I counsel a woman, I can say, this is what you can do. You can be trained. You have a way out.
We have a comment from Mark from Oak Island. He says, some women seem to deliberately try to escalate hostility, no matter how decent some people may be. Some women aren't comfortable with a nice relationship, and they're used to an abusive relationship. Dr. Clements?
Well, Mark, I want you to take a good look at where that statement came from. I think that's not an uncommon belief. It's somehow the woman brought it upon herself. And sometimes you can hear victims say this. I shouldn't have provoked him. I shouldn't have talked to him when he was drinking, et cetera. The truth is that I don't care what a woman does. She doesn't deserve to be hit. Right? So I don't know what some woman or woman, you know, you may have countered, Mark, but, you know, women don't deserve to be hit. All right? And we have an inherent disadvantage in size. Go ahead, Mandy.
Yeah. And also just, okay, so no one is saying that victims of domestic violence are perfect people who are walking around and, you know, are in perfect relationships. These things don't happen in a vacuum. But you always have another option. And just like, you know, what Dr. Clemens said, there's no excuse to resort to violence. And so if you were to find yourself in a relationship where you felt like you were with someone who was escalating and you weren't working things out, you have the choice to leave, you know? So instead of resorting to that, you could just leave.
We have Pete from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have unfortunately been involved with far too many of these situations, both back when I was a young military police officer and then eventually as I became a company first sergeant, I had to deal with this type of stuff all the time. And I have three questions, primarily for Dr. Clemens. What's the recidivism rate among males or abusive spouses? What is the recidivism rate? Second question, what is the success rate of a couple surviving as a couple after several incidents? And thirdly, is there any research in the fact that both abusers and victims, some, not all obviously, are attracted to this type of relationship? I'll pick my answer off here.
Thank you so much, Mark. Those are great questions. Well, let's talk about the recidivism rate and treatment. How successful is treatment for perpetrators?
The recidivism rate is very high. The number of men who go from abusive relationship to abusive relationship is very high, as is the number of women without treatment. Now, treatment for women tends to work better than treatment for men. So the options that have been talked about are very useful. The empowerment groups and counseling, et cetera, tends to enable a woman to step out of an abusive pattern of relating to others. The success rates for abusers are abysmally low. It depends on motivation. There, most of these guys are court mandated into treatment, and that results in less success.
It's an external, it's coercion. They're forced
Somebody's
into that circumstance, and so yeah, so still not taking responsibility.
They're checking a box. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that what seems to be more successful, and I don't want to give any abuser an out. You know, if you're an abuser, go get treatment somewhere, right? And I hope it helps you. But what seems more successful are community-wide programs in which our norms around violence are changed.
And through that grant that we're working with the CDC on, you know, we already talked about the faith community, but another really important component of prevention is to start young. And so we're working in the elementary schools, beginning in kindergarten, doing programs called Hands Are Not for Hitting and Words Are Not for Hurting, and having some really honest discussions with this next generation. Because if someone is an abuser, certainly they have choices. Certainly it's a learned behavior that they can unlearn. But our hope is that by reaching the youth of today, that we can create a society where this isn't acceptable.
And so theoretically, how would that go? Because again, so many people who don't understand the dynamics, you know, going back to the question, why does she stay? Janae Rice got knocked out cold in an elevator. Can't she just look at that video and say, whoa, I need to get out? So you're teaching a kid, so that this child, let's say, has never encountered intimate partner violence, doesn't know that, goes through a program, hands are not for hitting, learns about the danger signs. How would it be different for a child who had come through that educational process versus someone like Janae Rice, not knowing her personal circumstances? Mm-hmm. But how could that have changed the trajectory of what happened with her?
So I think there's a twofold answer there, because when we're talking about domestic violence, we're talking about victims and perpetrators. So a lot of the primary prevention work that we're doing is to prevent people from becoming perpetrators. So if you're working with a child, helping them understand the warning signs and the triggers that I'm feeling angry, I feel like my boundaries have been crossed, I feel like I need control of the situation. Those aren't inherently bad things, but teaching them how to cope with those skills in a positive way. Learning some tools like deep breathing, counting to 10, going to talk with someone that you trust instead of resorting to violence at a young age. So there's that component in working to prevent domestic violence before it occurs. And then also there's work to empower people to have healthy relationships at a young age. And so we do some works in the high schools. It's really important, called STARS. And that's a program that we do that talks to boys and girls about norms in dating relationships, about what a healthy relationship looks like, and some warning signs for not healthy relationships. And I think instilling self-esteem and a strong sense of belonging and self-worth and being connected to your community, all of those things are identified risk factors and protective factors in domestic violence.
And when we come back from the break, I'd love to just hear some of those signs of a healthy relationship and what's not so healthy for our listeners. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about violence between intimate partners, what the patterns are, what can be done, both on an individual basis and community-wide. If you have a question for our guests, Mandy Hooverus or Dr. Carrie Clements, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also tweet us at CoastlineHQR. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. And with me in the studio once again, psychology professor Dr. Carrie Clements and Mandy Hooverus with Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. We're talking about violence between intimate partners. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. And Mandy, before we went to break, you were telling us about a program in the high schools that you have that educates teenagers about what's a healthy relationship, what's a not so healthy relationship. Can you just give us some of the highlights of that? What is a sign of a healthy relationship for a teen?
So I think certainly respecting each other's boundaries, and you know, when we start to see people feeling entitled to control all aspects of the person they're with, that becomes a problem. And in an age where we have constant access to technology and cell phones at hand and all of these things, we're noticing some shifts there that young people today think that it's normal for their partner to be entitled to go through their phone, to be able to have access to their email passwords and things like that. So it's really just starting there, listening to the kids, listening to where they are, and helping them know, like, that's not okay. You're able to set boundaries. You're able to have trust and respect and love in a relationship without fear.
Right. You can have private email that is just yours, and it doesn't mean that you don't trust your boyfriend or
right.
your girlfriend.
Right.
So healthy boundaries. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what are some signs then, conversely, of an unhealthy relationship?
So like isolating you from your friends, from your support group, extreme jealousy, control, don't wear this, wear that. All of those are things that when we start to hear that, some red flags go up. And we do some great activities where even we'll show, read a scenario or show a video clip, sometimes even a Disney movie. Like, and that seems silly, but some of our animated Disney movies, Beauty and the Beast and classics like that, that we grew up loving, if we actually step back and look at them and the message they send about relationships, it's kind of alarming, you know, love this guy even though he's a monster. And then maybe if you stay with him long enough and prove yourself, he turns into a prince. Mm-hmm. And so even like breaking it down for the kids on that level can be really revelatory.
That is interesting. I'm not sure that's the message that I took from those archetypes, but I can see how that message would come across. Well, speaking about culture, Eminem is in the news, the rapper, because he recently, I'm not sure if it was in a circumstance where he was freestyle rapping, but he talked about hitting a singer, Lana Del Rey, twice like Ray Rice, and he referenced the elevator in this rap, and it was pretty ugly. One person said, I'm not sure why the misogyny in Eminem's lyrics never bothers me. I think it's because I recognize it as a legitimate artistic expression. Like much of the function of art is to allow us to express and explore complicated subjects and emotions and experience some sort of catharsis. What do you say to that, Dr. Clements?
Oh, that really, really disturbs me. And, you know, especially when I know that young people are listening to these lyrics and they're identifying with them, and that legitimizes behavior on their part. But I've got to say that, you know, I really feel that we live in a culture where violence against women is okay, and that women are afraid sometimes to even go to their families because they'll be blamed. It gets back to the comment earlier. What are they doing wrong? You know, why can't they make this right? Why can't they change things? You know, he'd be a better person if you only just fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And you know, I am such a powerful advocate of looking at things like Eminem and calling him out and having him take responsibility for people who are likely to identify with and act on that. It makes me just sick to see people in popular culture glamorize domestic violence
so,
in that way.
So this is not a legitimate artistic exploration to you. To you, this is some sort of glamorizing, as you say.
Or abusive behavior in and of itself. I mean, he's essentially saying it's okay. Right. You know, it's fine. You know, you can do this.
But then as a society, you know, if we buy those records and we listen to that, then we're validating that and saying, you know what, it's not that bad. And so that's where we start to have to really turn that mirror back and look at ourselves as a society and say, what are we willing to accept and what are we not?
That is a great question. Anonymous sent an email saying, thank you, Mandy. Yes, the question is, why does the abuser do what he or she does? I will say, though, as a survivor of domestic violence, the reason I stayed as long as I did was I came to believe that my husband came to believe. Mm-hmm. I think that's key here because that implies a progression. She didn't start out this way. Came to believe that my husband was right about me, that there was something wrong with me, and he was frustrated by my dysfunction. He even said at one point that he felt I wanted to kill myself but lacked the courage, so I was pushing him into killing me. We even went to a marriage counselor who was so charmed by my husband's charisma that she told me I needed counseling, but he didn't. I would probably not have survived if three different women hadn't taken me aside in the 2 weeks before I walked out. They all three independently said to me they were afraid for me. One had worked for domestic violence at one point, and she said, "You look like one of my clients. Talk to me." Again, here we're talking about all of the responsibility being placed on the victim of domestic violence. But the only way this circumstance will end is if the victim, Dr. Clements, mm-hmm. is able to actually make the decision to leave.
Yeah, and that's classic perpetrator behavior. You know, the reason I'm doing this is that it's your fault, right? You're evoking this from me. And if you would just get your act together, then this situation wouldn't occur. And to the extent that the woman is beaten down enough emotionally, she may buy into that. And that's part of the progression, recognizing that, no, this is not you, this is him.
It sounds almost like a prisoner psychology.
Very much so. Very much that Stockholm syndrome, that, you know, mm-hmm. people refer to it.
Yes.
And that's why I keep, you know, hammering at cultural norms, because she may hear this from her family, too. She may go to her parents, and her parents may say to her, you know what, you got married. It's your job to make this marriage work. And that's the kind of message. That woman was lucky, you know, that three women did that. Obviously, one of them was very well educated in domestic violence, but other women are not so lucky.
And additionally, that woman was incredibly brave.
Mm-hmm.
And people ask often, how can you do this every day? And how aren't you disappointed if someone goes back? So I answer that with saying, I'm blown away every day that someone has the courage to walk into my office, never having met me, and reveal the most private and frightening and intimate details of their life, and trust that I'm there for support. And so it is a process. I think that's important to remember. Leaving a violent situation we think of as an event. You pack your car, you put your things in, you drive off into the sunset. It's a process, and it's a long and complicated one. And additionally, you know, we made the point earlier, when you're leaving is one of the most dangerous times. And that doesn't mean that it's okay to stay or that we want someone to wait, but it means that we need a plan. And that's where our agency comes into place. So Domestic Violence Shelter and Services provides resources and support for victims here in New Hanover County. We are available 24 hours a day by calling 910-343-0703. And there are a whole host of services, emergency shelter being one of them. But many clients we work with maybe aren't in need of shelter. Maybe they're in need of safety planning support and court advocacy. That's a big thing. The court system's complicated and very intimidating. And so we have help to navigate that and explore what options are available.
We have Kelly from Wilmington on the line. Kelly, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. What's your question, Kelly?
My question is, what is the responsibility of women who report domestic violence? And also, is there any culpability when a woman simply claims domestic violence in order to have her boyfriend or husband put in jail? And there's really no basis for that. And let me tell you, I know from personal experience that friends of mine and others have been shanghaied by angry women, and even heard the police say, what you have to do is say that he put his hands on you.
So you're saying there have been women that have been vindictive and vengeful and then coached by police into basically framing an innocent male.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay. Thanks so much for your call, Kelly. Mandy.
So that's a really, you know, that's a valid concern, caller. And I couldn't, like, I do what I do because we know this is an important issue. And certainly, if someone is misusing the system to draw attention or for ulterior motives, you know, no one would condone that. But what we do know, you know, I served as our court advocate for many years. The criminal justice system is pretty thorough in trying to weed out false reports. And so there's no way to control that. You know, say every single, no one has ever misused the system. But day in and day out, the police officers we work with, they have very specific protocols. They know how to contact the right people, the right support systems if there is concerns about domestic violence. And our criminal justice system is really designed to protect the accused until they're proven guilty. And so that's kind of what we see.
Thanks for that. Anne, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, I will try to put this in a nutshell. My father choked my mother to death in 1967, and for 20 years he had been abusing her and my brother and me, mostly my mother. And I won't go into all that detail except to say, indeed, everything you said is true, except he had no alcohol problem. And that she had finally gone to court, got an order for him to leave the home. She had to go through that, and 10 minutes before the order went into effect, he choked her to death. Now, the suggestions I make are these observations. The first suggestion is my father was then diagnosed as manic depressive, and he was a classic manic depressive, and he was a gentleman until he went into a mania. And then he would become violent, and you could not deal with him. When they put him on lithium, he completely straightened out. And any time he got off his lithium, which he would occasionally do, he would go into his violent episode again. So I hope you will discuss and think about having a mental health evaluation for bipolar, for manic depression, because it plays a huge role in this inability to control anger. The second thing I'm going to say is this, and it won't be popular. The first step down the slippery slope is when a woman takes a man's last name when she marries him. She is giving up her own identity. She is bonding with him very closely. This begins to make it difficult for her to distinguish herself from him. And the other thing is this. I think every public school should have, as part of the phys ed or health program, self-defense skills taught, particularly for females, because I can tell you this. When a woman knows how to fight back effectively, she's pretty much solved 80% of the problem.
Okay, and you raised some
interesting
points here. Yes, thank you so much for your call. And, wow, that's hard to hear sometimes, that kind of violence. And, Mandy, you were reacting pretty strongly to that last point about self-defense. That's not really what you want to be teaching women to deal with this,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, so I certainly don't want to invalidate the last caller's experiences and perspective. And what we do, we actually, as part of our empowerment curriculum, we do teach a self-defense course that's available to victims. And so I'm certainly not opposed to people learning to protect themselves.
That's one of the tools in the toolbox.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I think it's important as well. You know, the caller raised some really troubling, details about her personal situation. But we don't want to generalize that, you know, anyone with a mental illness or anyone with a substance abuse issue is an abuser. And we also don't want to say that that causes it, because there are plenty of people out there who are alcoholics or maybe mentally ill who don't choose this behavior. So it's kind of, it can be like gasoline on a fire. It can certainly exacerbate the situation and make it more unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that that's always the root cause.
And this circumstance too, Dr. Clements, I thought it was interesting. She said as soon as she went for the restraining order, or whatever it was, that's when he acted. And this is what you're finding in your research, that the greater the perpetrator sees the loss of control, the more dangerous they become.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's a tragic circumstance, and I'm really, really, really sorry for the caller and what she experienced.
Yeah.
I do think that one of the single most important things we can do for young women and for women in these situations is to teach them what the filters are. So, you know, this person is behaving this way. Whatever you're doing, it's not you. And you need to make a plan to keep yourself safe or leave, and that's the most effective thing you can do. And if part of it is learning self-defense, that's great, and whatever other issues you need to do. But you need to figure out what the filters are, whether you're being controlled, whether you're being isolated, whether you're being hit. And if those things are happening, it's time for you to take a look at what you're doing and make some decisions.
And Mandy, yes.
And I love the analogy about the toolbox. That's actually one that I use a lot when I work with clients, because it's very easy to say, well, go get a protective order. A protective order will fix your problem. So as a court advocate for many years, like, I saw protective orders do amazing things. And what they do is they can set some really clear boundaries. But no one action can guarantee safety. And so we listen to a victim, we talk with her about her options, we educate her about the services and support that are available, and help her put together a plan that she feels will increase her safety.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left in the program. Mandy Hoover is from Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. Final thoughts, if you could get one message out today, what would that be?
Absolutely, that there is hope. So when we think about domestic violence and we see these images and we hear these horrible stories and things that happen, sometimes we shut down. And think that that's just a terrible problem, and I feel sad for those people. There's hope. There's services here in our community. By contacting us at 910-343-0703, we have advocates available 24 hours a day who can listen, offer support, and help make a plan.
Dr. Carrie Clements, UNCW psychology professor, where would you like to see some breakthroughs in research?
I'm not sure about breakthroughs in research. I guess the final message is that I would like the community to embrace this topic as they've embraced breast cancer or anything like that, so we can all talk about it. It's not stigmatized. It's us. It's not them. And then we'll be able to move forward on these fronts.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Carrie Clements and Mandy Hooverus. Thanks also to you, our listeners, and those of you who called in and emailed your comments. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Join us next week when we explore the role of the special use permit and how it could be modified. That's next week on Wednesday, November 19th, here on Coastline at noon. HQR News 91.3 FM. Our producer is Ken Campbell, associate producer Lindsay McGrath. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of our listeners and guests, and not necessarily of WHQR Public Radio. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.